The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, here with my ever effervescent co-host, a man just released from the hospital after having a dielectric breakdown. I thought you'd appreciate that, being an electrical engineer.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now you have to explain what dielectric breakdown is.
Yeah, too high of a voltage in a like air. It's what lightning is.
Yeah, that's basically our theme, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't tuned into the show before. We tell bad, geeky jokes and then explain them, thereby providing a learning experience.
Yeah, so
making
it's
them
actually,
less funny in the process.
It's actually funny. Well, the reason that's funny, you know, to always explain why it was funny, that's always, it's been useful for me since I was 12.
It's a bad rule of comedy, but it's
it
a good rule of education.
It is. Right? That's true.
And
that's
if you
true.
Think about it, I mean, dielectric breakdown voltage, mm-hmm. right? This is basically why you should not pee on the third rail. Can
yes.
I say that, or will the FCC ding
I think that's a good
well,
advice.
Well, we'll find out. I okay. think that's sound advice, and it's not a call to action. You're not calling for people to pee on the third rail.
There you go. So we have not violated our charter as a non-profit radio station.
Right.
But you actually do see that. If you go to the, the hardware store, you buy any of that WASP stuff that kills wasps' nests,
mm-hmm.
because you shoot it as a single stream into something, it will actually list the dielectric breakdown voltage on it, because you're connected to it while that stream's going, and if you shoot it as a transformer or a power mm-hmm. line, you could be in for a surprise.
Well, it's interesting. I went through this on my the engineering electrophysiology class. I teach that the membrane voltage in the axons for the action potential, that voltage is...
this is axon. These would be like nerve cells.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just translating.
Well, the conduits that communicate mm-hmm. Electrical signals from your spine, say,
and
to a muscle group.
And this is a big conversation topic at cocktail parties.
It is, and if you pipe down, I'll go ahead and get to my point, which does have to do with dielectric breakdown. But that the voltage that's there, the electric field gets generated, is just below the dielectric breakdown of the plasma membrane. So even though it's only 60 millivolts, for example, it's pretty close to the dielectric breakdown voltage.
So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Dielectric breakdown, a bad joke, but an interesting learning opportunity.
And not anything you can get psychological help with, which is where I started with all this.
All right. So let me just remind our listening audience that this is a live show today. So during the second half of the hour, we will be taking calls. If you've got a question or comment for our guests, please give us a call at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number is 404-894-2468. And, of course, if you're listening to the show on our website, WREK.org, the number is listed there. So the title of today's show is High Tech Weather, and our guest is Bruce Rose, who is currently the principal scientist and vice president at the Weather Channel. And he wanted me to stress that his job is equal parts software and equal parts meteorology. He's got a bachelor's and a master's in, is it physical geography from the Ohio State University?
That's right, Pete.
All right. And then you went on, and what was this, a midlife crisis? You did your PhD in atmospheric sciences at University of Illinois.
Midlife correction, I think we took.
Okay, so because most people just get a sports car like Bill.
Right.
So
right. I got a PhD in weather.
Okay, so we want to stress this, ladies and gentlemen, that we have one of the Weather Channel geeks with us. These are not the pretty people that show up on air. These are the people that really do the work. We're trying to point out that the scientists and engineers actually add value to society. So, and he's actually going to talk to us not only about general weather stuff, but about the Weather Channel and its high-tech use of technology and computers to deliver all this wonderful weather to you in all sorts of different modes, and perhaps how that's changing the face of weather prediction and weather observation. And, you do have sort of a diverse background, right? So you were at the University of Illinois for a while, worked there as a research assistant.
Right.
Early experience includes site director at the B School, as they call it, right? The Harvard Business School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Where else were you?
That must have been strictly by site director. You mean it was computer?
Sure, computer and networking.
Cool.
Right.
At Harvard.
He was at, computer...
H-A-H-V-A-H-D.
Technology. There is no R there. That's right.
Yeah.
It's just an H. Computer Technology Corporation, and also worked running the administrative systems for... And I know this because I go to Cleveland a lot. Cuyahoga Community College.
Now you pronounced that correctly.
Yeah, in the Cuyahoga Valley.
That's startling.
Well, I work with a lot of folks at B.F. Goodrich, so I travel there a lot.
Right.
And you have to know that.
Well, and one thing to point out here, too, I'm just... guessing that there's so much computation in weather and other things that you do that a skill that you kind of pick up along the way with that, I presume, is a lot of knowledge about computers. Is that correct?
Yeah, anybody in meteorology, in weather, the weather business, typically has real strong computer skills. You have to. That's probably true of all the hard sciences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything has the computer involved in it. So it was sort of a natural for me. And in fact, there are other strange people like myself around the country that are into these sort of weather systems, the nexus of computers and meteorology.
Okay.
So, the other point I was going to make, too, was for people that are listening that are in school and trying to figure out what they want to be when they grow up. This is one of those deals where, he had a skill set, Dr. Rose had a skill set that allowed him to go into something other than weather. Initially.
Right.
So by virtue of doing the PhD, you get these other skills that are very, very formidable, and you don't necessarily go directly into what your PhD says.
Right. The cross-disciplinary nature of mm-hmm. technical stuff is
makes
very,
you skilled very important. For other things, right.
Right. So don't think that's unusual. That mm-hmm. is probably becoming the norm more than anything, right?
Right. Yep.
Trent, who's working the big board for us today, right? Discrete mathematics major, but yeah. You do software programming.
Yeah.
And he's been known to be indiscreet at times. As well.
Right.
But
the mathematics
never going to get old.
Always discreet.
Well, it may get old, but it'll never get untold.
Right. I never get tired of that joke, which explains why I have no social life.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. So before we start into the whole idea of how weather prediction has changed and weather systems, let's start, as we often do, with science in the news. So I went to Popular Mechanics this week, Bill, because I thought Popular mm-hmm. Mechanics, people got to read that, right? I may not be popular. I may not look at it. But from the August 2008 edition, that's volume 185, issue 8, we have one of the tech news briefs, often subtitled Reports from the Edge of Science, entitled Pressure to Change Mortuary Science.
Now, this is not their thing that's reports from the wedgie of science. Which
no,
would be totally
that would not.
Thing.
The edge, not
it
the wedgie.
Edge, okay.
That would be you and your ilk.
I'm just writing this down.
I just wanted to use the word ilk today.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
So it begins by pointing out, dissolving bodies in lye is not just for mafia hitmen anymore. And frankly, any science article that starts out like that mm-hmm. frightens me.
Yeah.
But apparently, an Indiana company is touting alkaline hydrolysis, which is the fancy word for dissolving something in highly caustic, highly alkaline solutions to dispose of cadavers. A body is placed in a stainless steel container and exposed to lye at 300 degrees Fahrenheit and 60 pounds per square inch of pressure until the soft tissue breaks down. And I think
so. Alkaline is basic, so this would be pH,
sodium hydroxide, potassium
9,
hydroxide,
10, something like
right?
That.
So hot. I mean, actually, this is probably pH like 13,
okay,
something
wow,
like that.
Yeah, okay.
And so high pH means very basic, very alkaline. Low pH means very acidic. But I think the technical word I would use to describe this is ugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is this science gone too far? I don't know.
Can you use that in cooking?
Well, actually, you do use a fairly concentrated alkaline in cooking. What is it? The
baking soda?
Lutefisk from, where is that, from Sweden?
Really?
They basically put fish in lye and...
Oh, okay.
We use lye
in
cooking.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, as opposed to using it in her hair, like you,
right.
Bill.
Yeah,
that's
well,
all I'm saying.
I'm having a bad hair day. Thanks for bringing
that up. But company officials cite the environmental benefits, saying that cremation process produces carbon dioxide, and, you know, that is a greenhouse gas from body tissues. And then, of course, you also release mercury from dental fillings. So I don't know if they go in after the dental fillings, but I don't know. I just thought that was interesting. Our second Science in the News article from the same issue of, Popular Mechanics, mm-hmm. entitled Lightsabers for Dentists. So trips to the dentist could become less frightening. Courtesy of researchers in China's Huazhong University of Science and Technology, they've created a jet of cold plasma by charging helium, oxygen, and nitrogen electrons with pulses of electricity, resulting in a 1.5-inch plasma plume that is safe to the touch but can slice the thin cell walls of bacteria. They claim that it can be used to sterilize equipment and actually clean teeth. So you might want to explain what a plasma is, and particularly what a cold plasma is.
Right. So if you think about the three states of matter, you start out at a low temperature, and water is a solid. It's ice. Heated up above freezing, and it melts, and it's a liquid. Heated up further, becomes a gas. Heated up much higher than that, And you start to strip electrons off, and then it's a plasma. So a plasma is a charged gas. And you can just think of it as sort of as the fourth state of matter. And the sun is a plasma.
Right. So if you want a hot plasma, so a flame could be a hot plasma.
Right, right.
But you can make them by exciting them with, like, radio waves and other things like that.
Right, so, right.
And, Bruce, feel free to chime in unless we're just grossing you out with that cadaver story. Yeah. That's why we always introduce the guests first, because the guests are often like, this is what you people spew out over the radio? What's wrong with you?
I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
Absolutely.
I thought getting a base of 12, 13 up towards 14 was really, really difficult.
It is difficult, but, I mean, in theory, you can make...
Versus an aqua regia, you know, a really strong acid.
So you can make acids that... So if you go down to acid, you can actually make an acid so strong it actually has a negative pH. It can actually go below zero, right? So bases... You can, don't make me do the math for you, Bill, right? These things are so constituted, they're actually oils. But even that doesn't even come close to this, what is this, this molecular acid that spills. I'm looking at Trent like, it's, well, I don't know what you're talking about. This molecular acid that comes out of the aliens. And yeah, it is difficult to do it.
Something in the pizza that he's eating.
But actually, the solubility may change when you put it at high temperature and high pressure as well. So you could definitely get near there.
I'm going to Google that later. Negative.
Yeah, okay. Me too.
pH numbers.
Negative
pH. I don't buy this.
I'll bring
ahead.
The numbers in.
Isn't that like that 11 on the... The scale in spinal tap.
It is, Just turn it up to 11. Yeah.
Well, it's not 10. Yeah.
It's not 10.
It's 11.
It's 11. You need that extra little oomph there.
So I'm going to do a joke on that. It's Pete, your pH meter goes to 15. Well, it's not 14. It's 15. Okay. And if you haven't seen Spinal Tap, well, you're calling the authorities now or reporting us to the FCC.
Right.
So let's start with, first of all, our guest is from the Weather Channel. So what is the Weather Channel? What do they do? How'd they get started?
The Weather Channel is started in 1982. We celebrated our 25th anniversary when we launched this cable channel, the Weather Channel, in 82. People thought we were crazy.
Yeah, they thought CNN was nuts.
And that was here in Atlanta, right, that it started?
It was here in Atlanta. And it took about 3 or 4 years to become profitable, successful. Now, today, the Weather Channel has 100 million cable subscribers.
Wow.
They have 35 million unduplicated users per month on weather.com. They're a leader in mobile. Other important thing to say about the Weather Channel for this discussion, I think, is that we specialize in business to consumer, right? So we're all about getting the weather right for the average consumer. I'm a weather enthusiast, and I just like to follow the weather. I'm a mom trying to get the kids off to school. I work outdoors, landscaping business. I'm weather sensitive, right? And this is our target audience, and these are the people that we're trying to serve.
Right,
and you guys must be fairly accurate in order to be in business this long. I mean, I can remember listening to a weather account when I was in Champaign, Illinois, going to grad school, and they said it was 50% chance of rain, and it was already raining. So, I mean, you tend to ignore everything else after that, but you guys must be pretty accurate with the predictions, as well as when there's something like a hurricane going on, you guys are there.
I think we're pretty accurate. You get this, a common lament. Heard this my Alta tennis match the other day, and this guy say, you know, what a great job. You can go in and you only have to be right 50% of the time, and if you're wrong, there's no consequences. Say, well, That's not really the case on either side of that equation, right? Because we do a lot of formal verification of our weather forecasts, and in fact we compare those to competitors' weather forecasts, and also we you know, on the other side of the equation. There are a lot of consequences if you get this forecast wrong. Today in Atlanta, You know, a wrong forecast, what's a wrong forecast? The skies are going to open up and it's going to rain. Well, that's extremely unlikely. That's probably not going to happen. Did we miss the temperature by 5 degrees? My point is, the consequences, there's not a lot on the line today in Atlanta.
Right.
But there's other days. You remember last winter, we had a couple of nice snow events, one on a Friday evening. Made the traffic very interesting.
Yeah.
One on a Saturday afternoon, and both times we had over an inch of snow. And the prediction of those high impact events, there's a lot more riding on it.
And tornadoes is another one, right, where people are
absolutely
very concerned about being notified ahead.
Do you
of
get
time.
Nasty emails when you're wrong?
Sure.
Probably from Bill, I'm guessing.
No, not me. From my wife, maybe.
Oh,
she's
okay.
Actually, interestingly, her dad was a pilot for Eastern, and he passed away a number of years ago, but she would sit with him, and he would watch the radar, being shown, and he was better at predicting the weather than the people on the local weather channels were. But he needed to know what the weather was if he's flying a plane.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so she just sort of picked that up and follows it.
Hey, there's an interesting website out there, and I think it is Forecast Advisor, one word, .com, forecastadvisor.com. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because if you asked me, loyal employee of the Weather Channel, well, how accurate are your forecasts? I could tell you, and I think the listeners might take that with a grain of solace as well. The guy works here.
Right.
Forecast Advisor is actually independent. Guy who verifies lots of weather forecasts from different providers. And he has this on a free website, and you can actually show the Weather Channel versus the National Weather Service or versus some of our other competitors.
Wow.
And, of course, I bring this up because the Weather Channel does pretty well
one,
in this comparison. But I thought that was an interesting little niche. I mean, he really is sort of the consumer. He's trying to be the consumer
reports
of weather.
So he's the consumer reports of weather.
Absolutely.
All right. Always good to get independent verification.
His name is Eric Floor, by the way, and he's in Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, well, cool. Good to know. So now, how have, I guess, predictions and the whole way we get our weather changed? I mean, it's drastically different.
Well,
right
if we
now.
Go back in the Wayback Machine, I'm thinking Farmer's Almanac. You know, 100 years ago, people would try to use this to figure out when to plant and all
that.
Yeah,
should we be listening to how can you predict the whole season ahead of time? This is what I want to know.
Well, let's say we have a U.S. sort of centric view of weather forecasting. Mm-hmm. If you go back about 120, 130 years, you're starting to see, as the United States expands, you're starting to see the government is becoming aware of how sensitive they are to weather. And there are some big weather disasters, right? Typically hurricanes in the south, and there's starting to be the rudiments of electronic communication, telegraph. You have an agrarian society, and agrarian society is also weather sensitive, and there's also a lot of naturalists that are recording weather information. So it was a sort of a natural next step to start hooking people up, and what I mean by that, they started to report the state of the weather.
Ah.
Then the next step after that, the mathematicians and the engineers came in and said, well, shouldn't we take a crack at extrapolating our current state that we collected all of the observations? Can we take a crack at sort of modeling or extrapolating that into the future and actually make a prediction of the weather? At one time, predicting weather was illegal.
You're kidding.
When was that time?
We were talking early 1900s.
Bill's thinking it was the current administration.
This wasn't five. This wasn't 4 years ago.
Okay.
We're still back.
I've got to ask this question, right? Because we try to deal with the logic of science and technology. Why would anyone make predicting the weather illegal?
Because of the alarmist. It's like
there'd be a run on the bank.
Yelling fire in the theater.
I did not know that.
So there, was there precedent for that? I mean, a panic? Panic setting in, or was it? I mean, you had what was the movie where the locusts were coming, and it was I think it was about the Mormons going. Anyone had this vision? You know, they're sitting there, or they're waiting for rain, or the dust balls, and you know, people. It's what the weather was doing in agrarian society is very critical to your future.
Right.
Right. So the panic idea does make sense. But you make a very interesting point. You talk about the telegraph. So what you're saying is, to some degree, weather reporting and telecommunications kind of develop together.
Sure.
Because one depends on the other. Wow.
Sure.
And so really what you do at the Weather Channel is sort of the extrapolated 100 or more years later ultimate manifestation of that? Is that a fair thing to say?
That's right. And I mean, with the computer, there's also been sort of a second renaissance in in weather forecasting and meteorology. I remember back in the 70s, I mean, weather information was really sort of hard to come by. You had the newspaper, you could dial the weather person on the telephone, and then you watch the 6 o'clock news and your favorite local weather guy. I mean, compare that to the state of the art today. Online, on air, podcast, mobile.
Right.
I mean, it's weather information has really exploded. It's at everybody's fingertips right now. And I think one of the things that brings, though, is a little bit of confusion, or it may even be an opportunity. I used to have a go-to weather source of information. This is how I got my weather information.
Right.
Where now, especially young kids, are so fast to go online and Google this, Google search, and everything. I mean, it's really easy to collect sort of a lot of different opinions of what the weather's going to do. You wouldn't do it today, again. But the day before that severe weather outbreak or that possible ice storm, are you going to go to get your milk and bread or not?
Which they always do in Atlanta. What's the deal with that?
Well, it's because we don't know what those little white flakes are, and it scares so many people.
There
it's amazing. Compared to Illinois, where,
Well, we'd stay holed up in 3 feet of snow outside for a week, and it wouldn't bat an eye.
What's a strange human thing, too? You fear the unknown, so people here get very worried about what might happen with snow because they rarely see it. But, people living in a trailer park in Alabama don't bat an eye about a tornado coming through, and you know it's going to hit them. That and the alien, the UFOs are going to land there, but they don't seem to be concerned about it, I think you fear the unknown. I mean, people in the Midwest, it's amazed me how little concern there was about tornadoes, and there's lots of wind there.
They happen all the time.
But mention the word earthquake, and they're just scared.
Right. Whereas I lived in California, and earthquakes were a common thing.
Yeah. Right.
So how does – so we got all this information, right? I get it right on my BlackBerry, and I can access it anywhere, and I do. I log on, and I go to places like weather.com, and I get it constantly. That must be, what, terabytes? What, petabytes? That's the next one. I mean, just unbelievable amounts of information. How do you get all that stuff on the cable station, on all these different routes? How does that work?
Well, it's interesting. We started with verification, meaning accuracy of forecast. But in our little line of work, our little weather systems line of work, things like reliability, which means our point-to-point systems don't go down, right? They're very reliable. They run 24/7, 365, and if one goes down, there's a lot of redundancy. So there's a reliability component, which is very critical. There's also what we call latency. Latency, let me give you an example. Latency is Fulton County Airport just reported a thunderstorm, and we want to disseminate that piece of information, right? It's an observation, and we want to push it out there to all of our platforms and all of our partners so they know that this has just happened. Well, if it takes us a half an hour to do that,
right,
that's not good, right?
Absolutely.
And in fact, you find a lot of bottlenecks in the sort of the total system. And so this latency, reliability, and accuracy are sort of the three legs of the stool when it comes to this weather information. So I didn't answer your question directly, and I suppose the direct answer is it's like you imagine, Pete. It is a lot of data, and it's all real time, and it's all very perishable. Imagine how perishable a tornado warning is and how well you have to engineer those communication systems to, once there is a human decision point, in a National Weather Service forecast office. They either get a report or they get a signature on the radar display that says this is a tornado. They compose or create the warning, and then they push the button. And then a lot of stuff is supposed to happen, and it's supposed to happen really fast.
Right.
If you're watching the Weather Channel, and you're a cable subscriber, so you have mm-hmm. the local on the 8s, and
right.
you know, you get your local forecast information. You know, typically the button is pushed by the National Weather Service guy or gal mm-hmm. who says there's a tornado warning for Cherokee County. You will start to see that information appear on the Weather Channel in 3 seconds.
Wow.
That's about the lag.
Okay. Okay. And, okay, back me up on this, Trent. That sounds like a real, I'm being a geek now, real cool computer science problem. Because I used to work for a software company, and what people don't realize is with all those redundant, backed up systems that you have, there are just, you know, billions and billions of things going back and forth in these messaging, these message systems. And when you hit that button, something has to say, look, this has a certain priority,
right.
and I need to trim back the number of processors that are crunching this, that, and the other thing, and get things streamlined through there. That's a real cool problem.
I'm about to send you the forecast for next Friday.
Yeah.
It's like, don't do that. Just hold off
right,
on that.
Exactly.
Because I got a tornado warning here. That's going to go to the front of the line. That's going first.
Wow. So you mentioned before that some of your predictions are machine predictions, right? So what's a machine prediction, and how does the human get involved in that down the road?
Well, you're talking about forecasts now. Imagine a pyramid, and the base of the pyramid is all of the numerical weather simulation
Mm-hmm.
and statistics.
Right.
So that's what we mean when we say machine. Computer models based on mathematical abstractions of the three-dimensional atmosphere mm-hmm. and then a marching numerical problem off into the future.
Right. So you have cold fronts, you have precipitation, you have temperature changes, and they are all moving based on the last hour or day or several days. And you, again, we used the word extrapolation before, make some assumptions,
yep.
push that out an hour, a day, several days, and then see what that does.
So the second part of the pyramid is less mathematical and it's more statistical.
Uh-huh.
The top of the pyramid is the human, and the human is there to oversee and intervene and tweak and tune the machine forecast.
Okay.
So the state of the art today is we typically do not go end-to-end. In other words, the computer does not create, or the forecast you see is not solely a computer-generated forecast. It is a combination. It's an amalgam of computer and human-directed
mm-hmm.
information. We thought that by 2010 or thereabouts, we would actually be sort of pushing this envelope where it would be 100% automated end-to-end.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's as likely. I think mm-hmm. the human intervention part of this is going to go on for quite some time.
Okay. Well, we'll hold that thought. Let's talk about how the human is introduced into the prediction process and how a lot of people still think the human face, voice, what have you, is important in the delivery process. After this break, we'll take a quick break here on Inside the Black Box on WREK. Just a reminder, when we come back, we will be taking questions for Bruce Rose from the Weather Channel here at 404-894-2468. We'll be right back.
All the best and craziest electronic music. Tune in every Wednesday evening here on WREK Atlanta from 7 to 9 p.m. to the movies.
Join your host, Matt and Josh, on a space ride through future fun. From industrial to IDM, from noisecore to bit rock, dub, ambient, and everything in between.
We feature in-studio sets, live interviews, and recorded mixes from the finest in local, national, and international electronic music.
Focus on everything from labels such as Quark and Schematic Merc and all sorts of net labels to suit your synth fancy.
Every Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. All your electronic music needs, the Mobius here on WREK.
The home of true quality diverse music.
here on WREK Atlanta, the music never sleeps. Tune into Overnight Alternatives, weeknights from 1:30 a.m. to 6 a.m. on 91.1 FM, and let your ears guide you.
For the past 24 years, you've looked to a leader in Atlanta to help solve your musical crisis every week. That leader is Personality Crisis, heard Sunday evenings at 10 p.m. on WREK Atlanta. Personality Crisis, during its term of service, has brought Atlanta 2 Super Bowls, 5 World Series, the Olympics, and a national championship for Georgia Tech football. Okay, like politicians, we're overstating our accomplishments here. Personality Crisis has brought Atlanta the best new music, new wave music, punk, power pop, and U2 emails that other states could only wish to hear. If you elect to listen to Personality Crisis, we promise universal new wave, an end to the war on punk, and offshore power pop. Personality Crisis, Sunday evenings at 10 p.m. here on WREK Atlanta. I'm John Kincaid, and I approve this promo.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta, where we're chatting about the high-tech nature of modern weather prediction and disbursement with Bruce Rose from the Weather Channel. Just a reminder, this is a live program, so if you have a question or a comment about the weather and this high-tech nature of it today, give us a call at 404-894-2468. So we were talking about the human face on weather, and this is the green screen people. Can I call them that? Do they still use green screens?
Sure. We call them on-camera meteorologists, or OCMs.
Okay. And how many of them are meteorologists?
They all have at least a certificate.
Okay.
In meteorology.
Right. They go through some training in meteorology.
Absolutely.
Right.
And they are...
They can spell meteorology.
That would be you.
That would be me. Okay. No, I can't spell anything.
They're very well prepared and well briefed, and
right.
Some of them are... crackerjack forecasters and meteorologists. So some of the people on camera are also very, very knowledgeable and talented.
And they're all good with the green screen. Because I've done that, and that is tough. You know, I'm fumbling around, pointing at things. It's pretty ugly.
And it's important that they look better than Pete or I. That's an important.
Yeah, as you said
too,
before, we have faces for radio.
Yes, we do. Yes,
all right. Do we actually have a caller, Trent?
Yeah. Give me a second.
With an actual question or just requesting we be stripped from the airwaves?
I'm not sure.
A little bit of both. Yeah.
He's hitting a lot of buttons, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello.
Hey guys, how are y'all?
Yeah,
good, how are
you're
you?
On Inside
good.
The Black Box.
I just want to first say I enjoy your show. I just actually started tuning into it. I enjoy your show; it's very educational.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Got a question for your media, your guy from the Weather Channel, though. So this will be a tough one, though. My question for him is: if he had to pick out of the 3 major meteorologists out of the Atlanta area, who would probably be the best meteorologist to tune into? Out of like the Fox, NBC, or ABC?
So do you even watch these guys on TV, Bruce?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've been in Atlanta for 10 years, and sure, I find myself tuning in once in a while. I think the diplomatic answer, I wouldn't name anybody, but I think Chris Holcomb is good. I don't know if he's even still on the air, but I always thought his presentation was good. He was pretty much spot on when it came to explaining scientific things.
Oh, okay. So is Chris Holcomb still on the air?
He is. He actually still is on the air. I'm just curious. He actually just, I think, took over Flip Spiceland's thing in the morning time. But I was always curious, and I would totally agree with him, but I was always curious why he didn't get to become a chief meteorologist. And that he seems like he sometimes knows more than the other guys. I would totally agree with you on that.
You know, I think it's because he didn't have a name like Flip Spiceland.
Is that somebody's actual name?
That's his name. I hope he changed that name. I hope he wasn't born with
Flip
that name.
Spiceland?
It's got to be a stage name. Spiceland. Flip Spiceland.
Name your kid that, and he's going to go into therapy. It doesn't matter what happens to him.
Well, there you have it. I mean, so I don't know why.
There's a part to this, and especially in the local TV market, where it's like, well, if nobody's watching, you're in trouble, right? It doesn't matter how great of a meteorologist you are. If somebody's more, entertaining or more dynamic on the air. And you know, so I like Hurricane Schwartz. Hurricane Schwartz is a guy in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and you know, it's just I like his name, I like his style. He cracks jokes,
right?
You know, does he know more than the next guy? Yeah, probably not.
Didn't David Letterman do the weather at one point in Indiana?
Yeah,
I think he said they had hail the size of canned hams.
And Flip Spiceland has perfect hair. I have to say that I do watch him, and it's perfect. So maybe that's it.
Well, guys, I really appreciate your time and all that, and I've enjoyed the program, and I'm going to tune in more often and hear different things you guys do. But thanks for the educational today.
Spread the word. Thanks for
calling. Guys. Bye.
All right.
Yeah, are we getting in trouble for making fun of Flip Spiceland's name?
I think you should, you know, give him a reward for that.
Everybody went to junior high school with it, I'm sure.
That was all Pete. I didn't.
Right, so in no way is there any culpability for the Weather Channel or weather.com.
That kind of ties into the human aspect, too. I mean, people, they don't just want something rolling across the screen at the bottom that says, you know, it's going to rain today or whatever they want somebody to describe. And also Atlanta area is so big. I mean, you could be living in a different part of the city and not be getting rain or getting rain some other.
You
really want a description, a verbal description, I think, more so than just
well,
text.
You know, there's a
media.
There's a practical aspect to this. If Jim Cantore's on air today and he's talking about Atlanta's weather, he's going to be pretty light and he's going to crack some jokes and he's going to have a good time with it.
Right, because it's cool, breezy, it's great out there.
But if he's on the air the day before, you know, Hurricane Ike landfall, it's a totally different situation. And in fact, that's where a little of this breaks down, because the pendulum sort of swings back and forth, especially in these local markets, between I want an entertainer, I want a meteorologist. The problem with the entertainer is putting him on or her on the air the day before Hurricane Ike makes landfall. So you can see the dilemma for a programmer. You can see the dilemma as a sort of a public
communication
point.
It's not when you want to see somebody smiling a lot. You know, the hurricane's coming on land.
Right.
And, you know, 50,000 people displaced from their homes.
And that's
laughing
a good point. So we actually
really
had
that.
Some trouble getting you here, because I first called up the Weather Channel to find a suitable guest, and they're like, oh, no, we got hurricanes backed up like, you know, airplanes at Hartsfield out there in the Atlantic Ocean, maybe in a few weeks. And you guys, do you like get the beeper going off at 3 in the morning?
Yeah, luckily, really? things finally quieted down.
Yeah.
But you should visit sometime when there's a big tropical system or a big winter storm going on. I mean, it's really a busy place. And we're all busy. The weather is the work is somewhat seasonal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in what I do, less so. But we all feel it. And you can imagine in the programming part of this, where they're actually putting the weather on air and online. I mean, there's a lot of activity when there's one of these big storms.
But do the people sort of address the trust issue that, you know, it's the same forecast, but they want to hear, and that's the weather today. This is Walter Cronkite. They like that? They somehow feel
you know,
that's more accurate?
He's still alive.
I know he's still, what are you saying? I'm butchering the program?
No, I'm just saying he's going to come after you, yeah.
That's pretty good.
I'm just saying, yeah.
So, that's human nature, and that's true of science in general. I mean, isn't that what we're trying to do here? We're trying to make it slightly, ever so slightly, ladies
more
and gentlemen.
More palatable, yeah.
Less boring.
Right.
All right, so you had a question.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that, has circulated around is we had these tornadoes during the SEC basketball championship, and it hit the Georgia Dome in downtown Atlanta.
Right.
I could not remember ever a tornado hitting a big city. So, I mean, you'd think Chicago would get pummeled with them, or St. Louis or Indianapolis. And so I've heard everything from, oh, it's an old wives' tale, it won't hit a big city. Or, I guess the recent one is a conspiracy that it was actually a new Defense Department weapon that was fired at Atlanta.
Deflection force, yeah.
Yeah. What is the history on tornadoes or severe weather like that, a tornado hitting a big city?
There is some, I don't even know, I'd call it research, speculation that because of an urban center has buildings, and we would call these large frictional elements.
Right. They change the fluid mechanics of the air.
Yeah, but
really?
I
more so than temperature? You think?
Well, no, that's what people claim.
I'm saying there's some speculation that this could play a factor, but if you actually just look at the numbers, if you take the three-dimensional volume of the atmosphere and you look at the amount of real estate that's covered with, you know, large metropolitan areas, well, the chances are,
right,
you know, 20 or 30 years is going to go by before a big tornado would hit a urban center. Now, we had our tornado in Atlanta. There was one in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
Not too long ago, I guess it's been 5 or 6 years now, that was captured on traffic cams.
Right.
And I think there's been some others. Nashville, but I believe, had a really close call.
Now, hold on. Was it the downtown part of Salt Lake City? I've
Absolutely.
Never been there. So it was downtown?
It was right downtown.
Salt Lake City. Well, God doesn't like the Mormons. That's what that's telling you.
Always
right
with the cheesy social. Yeah,
Bill said that.
Yeah. And I work
again, there is no liability.
My name is Bruce Rose, and I work for the Weather Channel.
I love Salt Lake City.
And I'm not knocking it.
I did a set out there at a comedy club. And let me tell you this. The Mormon folks out there are very nice, and they have a heck of a sense of humor.
They know how to giggle.
Even when you tell Mormon jokes.
They know how to giggle, yeah.
They do.
That's because they got all that food saved up for a whole year.
All right, let's not
give these guys a hard time. But Nashville got hit.
Close call, and I think I don't remember the details, but it was a close call or a tornado actually in the city limits.
And when was that?
We do have a question or a call.
Yeah, probably a sensible question that's not going to poke fun at religious groups, Bill.
It was because they didn't recognize Johnny Cash as brilliant. That's why Nashville got hit.
Hello?
Hello.
You're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, yes, you're on the air. You're right inside the black box. Question?
Hello? Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Actually, a tornado came through Atlanta in 1975, destroyed the Perry Homes housing project, and knocked the columns off the governor's mansion.
Wow.
It does happen occasionally.
Wow. I was not here then.
It was the spring of 1975, and it blew through one morning, and... You know, I mean, some people said, well, maybe it could have, you know, ripped up the governor's mansion and just disturbed the trees at Perry Homes. It might have been.
Right. So, again, it's Bill's theory. It was the focus tornado.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, like the secret NASA weapon. No, it does happen occasionally. But, you know, you wonder if the heat island effect and like he was talking about, all the frictional stuff and small real estate area and all that. But nonetheless, enjoying your show. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
All right. So it's not true that it never hits a big city.
Yeah, no, it's not true.
It's not true.
It does. Sure.
So as you mentioned before, it's a scaling phenomenon, right? Take the total number of tornadoes and the fraction that happen in cities, and take the fraction of cities that represent our real estate. If those are about the same, then...
Yeah, but the counter-argument is that there are very little of the land area of Alabama and Mississippi is taken up with trailer parks, and yet still the UFOs and the tornadoes manage
to... But wait, though, if you actually looked at... Well, let me think about that. I mean, so you could do that. Has anyone ever done that study? Looked
the trailer park correlation? I don't think that's appeared in the journals yet.
You don't think somebody's PhD?
You know, I'll be looking at
meteorology
after the show.
Yeah, there'd be a correlation between.
But another correlation could be that if you correlate it by damage, right? I mean, you can have tornadoes sort of move near a neighborhood and tear some shingles off.
Yeah.
If it moves near things up on cinder blocks.
Well, I was
going to knock
you from getting beyond the ridiculous, but I would think that tornadoes would be being sort of an unstable phenomenon would be much more difficult, like where they're going to touch down and that kind of thing. I would think that would be incredibly difficult, and what it was going to be like. Are there different kinds of tornadoes?
Yeah, there's different mechanisms that cause tornadoes. Tornadoes is a very small-scale phenomenon. The typical strong tornado may be only 100 yards wide at the base, while the typical computer model has a resolution of 10 or 15 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So these are phenomena that are occurring well below the operational models or the ability to predict
them.
So
let me back up to try to describe that. So... If on the computer you're looking top down at Earth and you've got models of various things, you've got the wind and the temperature and all sorts of things, you can only sort of say within a 5-mile area, is that what you said?
Yes.
That the conditions are right for funnel formation. So picking where within that 5 miles it's actually going to come down is beyond the the accuracy of the models. The data that you've got going into it as well, the radar. Whatever.
The way it works is there's a severe storms forecasters, part of the National Weather Service, and they will outline an area of risk that may be 12, 24, even 36 hours ahead, and to say, well, there, if something's going to pop, it's going to be in this general area. And then as you get closer to the event, you have the tornado watch.
Mm-hmm.
And tornado watch does not mean a tornado's been sighted or tornadoes are occurring. It simply means the conditions are ripe, and these conditions are imminent. In the next 3 or 4 or 2 or 1 hour, you could see tornadoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then that funnels down to the actual tornado warning, where a human or a radar computer algorithm says, there's a tornado vortex signature right there. Warn all the people downstream. Where downstream, you're talking about a really small area now. You're talking, you know, perhaps 10 to 50 miles downstream of the detected vortex signature.
Right.
So you can see how it works. It's mm-hmm. it's like, hey, keep your eyes and ears open.
Go to the basement. Right.
You know, at that point, you go to the basement when you hear the warning. You don't go to the basement when you hear the watch.
Right, right.
Well, so given all this data that gets, you know, modeled and then humans tweak it and it goes out over the air, and since so many people get it on the computer...
Should we define tweak? Is that too nerdy a comment?
Yeah, so what do when the humans get that machine prediction or that computer model, what do they do? What's a typical thing they might change?
You know, it's a good question. You're used to consuming weather forecasts as, well, you know, there's a little picture, shows some showers coming out of it, and the words say scattered thunderstorms, or there might be some words and sentences,
right.
You know, partly cloudy with an increasing chance of showers this afternoon, high in the mid-70s. That's not what the human forecaster is working with,
mm-hmm.
right? The human forecaster is sort of working with fields of temperature mm-hmm. and fields of probability of precipitation, or even the conditional probability of snow. So it's sort of in this digital form. And we have forecasters sort of sitting in front of a big workstation that has two heads on it,
mm-hmm.
right, or two big screens. On the one screen is all of the information they're trying to collect about what's going on now, how is the atmosphere behaving, is it sort of going according to Hoyle, is it following along with what the models are saying. On the screen in front of them, they then have a picture of the United States with all these points all over it, or a picture of the world with all these points of it. And this workstation has software on it where they're making gestures. And a gesture might be this area here, which includes a 2 or 3 state rough area. I want you to lower today's maximum temperature by 3 degrees. So in other words, the prediction of maximum temperature, and the gesture might be just as it's a rather slick graphical user interface, and it's all about making that as easy as possible for them. You see these movies where remember the Matrix movie, right? Mm-hmm. The last movie where the guys get into the big sort of robot machines that have the big machine guns.
Yeah.
Well, you know, why do they do that, right? Because they want to extend. Those things are called Waldos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those little things where your little arms become big, powerful arms.
Right.
They can do all these things. That's what we're trying to do in our forecast center. We're trying to create these Waldos where just with these simple gestures they can make incisive or broad changes, and they can do that very quickly because they got to push it on to the next step.
So then nobody looks at this map of the United States, and this goes out basically zip code by zip code. So what is this? 50,000, you know, individual
40,000 zip codes. It ultimately what they push downstream, the human forecasters, is 19,000 forecasts worldwide.
Okay,
out to 11 days into the future.
Okay.
The first 72 hours of that being at an hourly resolution, and then beyond that being a twice-a-day resolution.
Okay.
That's technically what they're pushing out.
So no one can sit there, glance at the few pixels for the Cuyahoga Valley forecast, and then literally type this in. Basically, they have that model. It translates to the little icon and the prediction, and they can circle giant parts of the state and say, look, change this by a few degrees high, a few degrees low. This stuff, go with the snow forecast. The stuff at the edge, let's call that slightly lower probability just based on what I know because there's hills there or something.
Yeah, sort of. But they also have some pretty, like, they can do microsurgery as well.
Okay.
If you're up north, and Pete knows this, is you have the lake effect snow.
Right.
And, yeah, the forecasters will be down in, you know, late December, and they'll be down at a really small scale saying, snow here, no snow here.
Ah, okay.
So they're doing microsurgery at that point.
When Lake Michigan starts to invert, you will change stuff right near the city of Chicago and not necessarily. Wow, sir, that's cool.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Maybe I misunderstood or got lost in the analogies there, but is there something that the meteorologist is using that sort of, when you were doing the hand motions, which everybody saw on the radio, do they are they putting in data by motion? I mean, are they manipulating anything about sort of the map with their hands in a sort of matrix style?
You know, I like to think of it as, if you were presented with a topographic map, and you had contours, or let's say it was even, this is low tech, it's just clay, right?
Right.
And it's a depiction of the topographic surface, mm-hmm. right? And you go in and say, no, that mountain's not there. It's actually a little further south.
So you might actually do that with a computer program?
Sure. Cool. You might pick the thing up and move it to the south, or you might just say, mm-hmm. you know what, just change this amplitude or change this frequency. That's really what they're doing.
So in a way, it's kind of like, the original term model. Somebody actually built a model of a car or a boat or something like that. So the mathematical modeling, you've actually got backwards clay in your hand, so to speak, and you can kind of move stuff around.
That's right.
Cool. Very cool.
That's right.
So with all this data, you know, being tweaked, being sent out to all these different markets, right, the question is, what will happen to the TV guy, right? I mean, you still have people showing the weather because we've acknowledged that people sort of like that and trust that. But I think now, is this what makes room for my wife's favorite show? What is that, Storm Stories?
Storm Stories.
She loves that. Right. And she wants to know, how do you do the simulation of those, the reenactments?
No, they just put people in a funnel.
Is there a guy with a big wind machine going, here, you know?
No, those are the forecasters with the Waldos are doing those, too. No, asked me a question
my wife made me ask you that question.
You know, we have long-form programming, and it Storm Stories has actually been sort of transplanted by some more current things, but we call that long-form programming. So, in other words, somebody turns on the Weather Channel and says...
A regular show, not
what's this?
Your four-minute forecast.
Yeah, I thought I was going to see cold fronts mm-hmm. and low pressures. Instead, I'm seeing this sort of dramatic story about a past storm. Mm-hmm. And they're very popular, but they're also sort of controversial, and it's when mm-hmm. some of our different interest groups come into conflict a little, because there's weather enthusiasts that go mm-hmm. to the Weather Channel, and they want it to be live weather 24/7. That's what they're counting on.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other people that are a slightly different ilk, like mm-hmm. Pete, who go in and say, hey, this is neat, too.
Yeah,
especially on this day where there's not much going on. It's like, I'd be happy to see a story about the Galveston hurricane.
That's the crazy thing.
But you asked the question about, you know, the role of the on-camera meteorologist. And I think that the perception today is still that's a lot of value added by that function. So we're a long way away from somebody saying, you know, it's all automated. We're just going to show you some graphics and computer-generated stuff. And after all the information is there. We've sliced and diced it, and mm-hmm. we've made it as accurate as possible. We've gotten it to you as quickly as possible. You know, what more could you ask for? But there is an intangible part, and there's also this whole sort of element of connection and, you know, wisdom that comes with, you know, Paul Goodloe's on there sort of walking you through this weather situation. And, you know, he can add a lot of value by doing that. So I mm-hmm. don't think that's going away just because the perception is that, you know, I like to consume the weather that way.
Okay, so they like mm-hmm. that person they know from that time slot. They don't want some matrix voice getting on the air and going, well, Mr. Anderson, that kind of thing. So
well, in the recent past, there was experimentation with these things called avatars.
Yes.
So there's actually meteorological or on-camera avatars, and say, well, we can get them to speak. And they don't have to speak in synthetic
language. These are sort of a realistic animated character that looks like them. If you go to the Simpsons movie website, you can make an avatar of yourself that looks like Homer. Right. I have one, by the way, and it's fabulous. It looks better than I do, actually.
Wasn't really much modification between you and Homer.
Was pretty easy.
They did not like the avatars.
Short walk there.
They did not like the avatars? Is that the...
It was sort of underwhelmed by the avatars.
Unless it's Bill and I, then they prefer our avatars.
Yeah. And I think there's a common reaction, which is this sort of this uneasiness, this, you know, Max Headroom, like, I don't know. This, it's not the same.
Right, you're dating yourself.
I want an analog right. human standing up there. Cool. I don't want this digital.
Analog. One of your favorite words.
That's right. That's right.
Digitized.
Yeah.
Well, I think the future, of course, I'm voting for reality weather. Channel reality weather shows. That's what I'm
going to like. Put some washed up Hollywood people in Hurricane.
See if they can handle the tornado, man. Survivor.
I see.
Survivor,
so you're
Hurricane Survivor.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So we're talking Big Brother, etc.
Big Brother
et cetera.
in the eye of the hurricane.
I suppose.
Gary Coleman in a hurricane, for example. So.
All right. I hate to burst your bubble, Bill, but we've come to the end of the show
where we usually look at
the section of what have we learned. So what have we learned, gentlemen? I think we've learned that weather prediction dissemination is drastically changed. It goes hand in hand with modern telecommunications.
It evolved.
Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah.
That evolved?
Yeah.
But despite all the automation, people still like to be engaged by the human. Is that a fair thing to say, Bruce?
Yeah, I think that's a great summary.
And we're not going to get rid of those guys anytime soon.
Nor do we need to.
I think.
Nor do we need to.
All right. So. Well, that's good to know. So, Bruce, thank you very much for joining us on the program. If you have any comments or questions about today's show and didn't give us a call, you can reach us at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Once again, that's comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Next week, we're hoping we'll have Eric Prebis from Fermilab in the Chicago area talking about Large Hadron Colliders. What's all the fuss about? Although, Bill, I realize I'm giving a talk next Wednesday, so we may have to pre-record that one.
Okay.
But hopefully you can join us next week on Inside the Black Box here on WREK Radio in Atlanta.
2 weeks from now, it looks like we'll have Bruce Ellis from Tennessee, who's involved in the voter, the electronic voting, and the struggle there to bring it back to paper voting.
Excellent.
So we should have him on the program.
All right. Thanks for joining us on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.